Good morning.
Good morning.
It's kind of interesting having all of this stuff, kind of new. Usually I'd be sitting on the cushion. It'd be all the way it's always been for years and years and years. And now I have to improvise, so it's kind of fun. See how it works. I got here about 30 seconds ago. I come from St. Paul, and they're having a race today. And there was no way to get on the highway. And so consequently, had to wind our way through the neighborhoods of St. Paul and Minneapolis to get here, but just under the wire. Just under the wire. I'm going to speak today about what are called the four sublime abodes. And this isn't a Zen talk, because in Zen we usually don't talk about the four sublime abodes, but it's part of our history. It's part of classical Buddhism. And I'm talking about them because we're the practice period that we're that's underway right now is looking at the historical roots of Zen meditation. And this is part of the historical roots that we'll be studying. For those of you who are familiar with this type of Zen we practice here, it's pretty bare bones. It's just sit. Let go of thoughts. Just sit. Shikantaza. So we don't often provide people handholds or tools to meditate. It's not part of our tradition. We do it. I'm doing it this morning, but it's not classically the way Soto Zen meditation is taught. It's sit down, face the wall, just sit. You're enlightened. The four sublime abodes are friendliness, sometimes it's referred to as loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Friendliness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. It was first spoken of by the Buddha many, many times, actually, in the discourses of the Buddha's talks. He talked about these four abodes many, many times. And I'm going to start off by reading one such talk, or an excerpt from a talk. And the Buddha here is, he's got a Brahmin, a son of a Brahmin, who has come to chat with the Buddha and learn what he could learn, and he's asking a bunch of questions. The young man's name is Subha. He says, Master Gautama, I have heard that the recluse Gautama is Buddha. I have heard that the recluse Gautama teaches the path to the company of Brahma. The company of Brahma, as Brahma in Hinduism is the god of creation. So we're talking about the highest level. Buddha didn't require that you believe in that Hindu cosmology, but it was the cosmology of the day, and so it's what people talked, the language they talked in. I have heard that the recluse Gautama teaches the path to the company of Brahma. It would be good if Master Gautama would teach me the path to the company of Brahma. Then, student, listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, sir, he replied. The Blessed One said this. What, student, is the path to the company of Brahma? Here a bhikkhu, or a monk, abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. The Buddha is saying, imbue your entire mind with the attitude of loving kindness. So above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, he abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving-kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So first he says, imbue your mind with loving-kindness, the attitude of loving-kindness, and then let it pervade the world. Let it go out in all 10 directions. When the deliverance of mind by loving-kindness is developed in this way, no limiting action remains there. None persists there. Just as a vigorous trumpeter could make himself heard without difficulty in the four quarters, so too, when the deliverance of mind by loving-kindness is developed in this way, no limiting action remains there. None persists there. This is the path to the company of Brahma. He says, just as a vigorous trumpeter could make himself heard, so it's without difficulty. Another translation is, just as someone who blows a conch shell can penetrate the universe, that is the path to the company of Brahma. And then he goes on and he says, again, a bhikkhu abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion. And in this text, there's then three dots, which means he repeats everything he said before about compassion, or about loving kindness, as to compassion. So fill the mind, your entire mind, with compassion, and then let it pervade the world and the universe. Take that attitude. With a mind imbued with altruistic joy, ... With a mind imbued with equanimity. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so above, below, around, and everywhere. And to all is to himself. He abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with equanimity, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. And so he goes on. But this is, again, this is these four abodes were described by Buddha a number of times. Then it was expounded on in a manual in the 5th century by Buddhaghosa called The Path of Purity. And in The Path of Purity, Buddhaghosa describes a meditation technique, because it's a meditation manual, a meditation technique that we're all going to do in just a few minutes. Now again, Zen doesn't talk a lot about the four abodes. I don't ever remember reading anything by Dogen that mentioned the four abodes, but it is part of our history. Sometimes they're called the four divine abidings. It is the cultivation of these attitudes of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity causes a practitioner to be reborn in the realm of Brahma. They are four virtues, and they're also four meditation techniques, practices that we employ to cultivate the virtues. Buddha would say they can be cultivated endlessly, and they are equipment of the mind, that is, for developing a mind that is without hostility or ill will. They are equipment of the mind for developing a mind that is without hostility or ill will. The first of the first is kindness, friendliness, loving kindness, benevolence, goodwill. The Sanskrit term is metta, and this is often referred to as the Metta Sutta, and it's practiced fairly regularly in Theravadan Buddhist centers. It's a spirit of generosity, which is free of any attachment or self-interest. It's the attitude you might have towards a good friend, wishing them well, wishing them the best. The second abode is Karuna, compassion. The Sanskrit is Karuna. And it's the hope that a person's compassion, the hope that a person's suffering will diminish, that they'll be free from suffering. And again, in Buddhism, suffering is the first noble truth. Suffering exists. And suffering is the discomfort as human beings in our skin we feel, the dissatisfaction, the always wanting something else, never feeling totally at ease and at peace. That's the suffering that the Buddha talked about. And compassion here is the desire that all beings be at ease and be free from that dissatisfaction, that discomfort, that suffering. The third, altruistic joy or sympathetic joy, it's mudita in Sanskrit, is the joy in the accomplishment of another person, rejoicing in the virtues and happiness of another person. So rather than, it's kind of the flip side of compassion, if you will, it's as someone experiences joy and peace and satisfaction, having a good heart towards them and supporting them. And the third one, equanimity, or learning to accept the eight winds or worldly concerns, that the peacefulness of non-attachment, the acceptance of what is arising right now without and a calmness about that. A while back I gave a talk on the eight worldly concerns or the eight worldly winds. And I don't think I'll go there right now, but equanimity, when you experience loss. Equanimity when you get something you really want. Because both of those can throw you right off your center. Experiencing equanimity no matter if you're praised or criticized. I mean, it's really easy when you're criticized to be thrown off base and feel, oh, you know, gosh, you know, what did I do wrong? But it's really easy to be thrown off base when you're praised. Oh, great, that's wonderful. But equanimity through all of that, just a calmness. So those are the four abodes. In Buddha Ghosa's manual on meditation practices, he identifies 40 subjects for meditation. And it goes into great detail on all of them. However, there are only two that Buddha Ghosa says are universally beneficial. All of the other meditation practices ought to be done only if there's a reason to do them. For instance, if you're full of anger, perhaps you ought to meditate on compassion. There's some meditations that require that you have a level of faith before you do them. So there are all sorts of reasons on these 40 that would be specific to an individual. But there are only two that are considered universally beneficial for all people. One is friendliness, meditation on friendliness or loving kindness. The other one is meditation or recollection of death. I find that quite interesting. I got a letter from a friend yesterday who was in Bali, And she was describing what a colorful country it is and how exotic. But she said that when people get together to eat, they always invite death to the table. They always invite the god of death to the table. I find it interesting, and I'm not going to go down that path, but there are only two beneficial, according to Buddhaghosa, topics of meditation universally. One is friendliness, and one is recollection of death. Under all conditions, beneficial. So all four of these abodes, all four of these attitudes or meditation practices bring emptiness into the present moment, into the social realm, into the social realm. So much of what we do in our practice here at the Zen Center is stare at the wall and attempt to bring equanimity, peace, a sense of emptiness, a sense of connectedness to ourselves on the cushion. And here, these attitudes and exercises are to bring those same qualities into the social realm. They're geared to relinquishing or letting go of anger and hatred and ill will. They are, as the Buddha said, equipment of the mind. That is, for developing a mind without hostility or ill will. What I'd like to do now is actually do one of the meditations as a group. And this is something, again, it's not standard practice for a Dharma talk at the Zen Center, but that's okay. So the way, and this comes straight from the Buddha's description, but the way that the concept behind this meditation, we will do it only with friendliness or loving kindness, but it can be done with each of the four abodes. The concept is to fill one's mind first with the attitude of friendliness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. And then extend it out to the world. And then bring it back in. So, let's do it. Just get yourself comfortable. I suggest maybe you close your eyes. And bring yourself to mind. Bring yourself to mind. Your whole self. All of your karma, right there. May I be happy. Free from ill. May I be free from hatred. Free from injury. Free from agitation. And may I be at ease. In joyful repose. May I be well and at peace. as I want to be happy and am averse to suffering, so also other beings. Now bring a dear friend to mind. Maybe it's a teacher, family member, loved one. Bring that person to mind. May this good person be happy, free from ill. May they be free from hatred, free from injury, free from agitation, may they be at ease in joyful repose. May they be well and at peace. Now bring to mind someone about whom you're indifferent. Maybe it's a coworker, a neighbor, someone that you don't have particularly strong positive or negative feelings about, but just someone out there in the universe. May they be happy, free from ill. May they be free from hatred, free from injury, free from agitation. May they be at ease in joyful repose. May they be well and at peace. And now bring to mind someone for whom you have negative feelings. Maybe it's somebody at work, maybe it's somebody with whom you're in conflict, maybe it's somebody you think is doing incredible damage to the world. But bring a real person to mind. May they be happy and free from ill. May they be free from hatred. Free from injury. Free from agitation. May they be at ease in joyful repose. may they be well and at peace. Let go of that person and bring to mind that individual to whom you are indifferent, and once more, may they be well and at peace. Let go of that person and bring to mind the person that's dear to you. May they be well and at peace. And let go of the image of that person and bring yourself to mind. May you be well. May I be well and at peace. Slowly bring yourself back to the room. Open your eyes, move your body a little bit. So this is a meditation practice that can be done by anybody at any time. And it is to cultivate an attitude of, in this case, friendliness, loving kindness. And it can be done similarly with compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. It's an exercise for developing a mind that is without hostility or ill will. A calm mind, body, and spirit. And we have the inherent ability, we have the inherent biological ability to have a calm body, mind, and spirit. It's in us all. Some people have a hard time with that, bringing to mind someone for whom you might feel hatred or negative feelings. And cultivating a sense of love, loving kindness towards them, wishing them peace, wishing them happiness. There are three delusions or three hindrances that the Buddha talked about a lot. Hatred, lust, and delusion. Those are kind of critical in Buddhism. Hatred, lust, and delusion. And these exercises are meant to provide in a social setting ways to minimize hatred, lust, and delusion. And again, we don't often use these kinds of techniques in Zen. We just sit shikantaza. And sometimes we Zen folks find these techniques a little bit dangerous, that you can get hung up on doing these mental kinds of techniques. But they are useful, and they can be helpful. And to the extent that they are, I encourage people to use them. And these clearly, these techniques are part of our heritage. Our Buddhist heritage, all the way back to the big guy himself. I'm going to end there. If people have any questions or reflections on what it was like to do that metta meditation, I should also say there are different ways to do the metta meditation. I chose a very specific, concrete way to do it, but there are different methods to do it. You can find that stuff in the literature.
Before I showed up here, I was a Theravada person, so this is something that I've never abandoned.
Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting what a lot of people have trouble with more than their enemy is themselves.
Yes.
In traditions where they do a lot of work, that you spend a lot of time on yourself before you move on to the benefactor and so on. To getting that foundation is important.
Yeah. Thank you. And for those of you who aren't aware, a Theravadin tradition is classical Buddhism. Really, it's close probably to what called Vipassana the tradition we practice here is a Mahayana tradition. It's kind of went through some reform, but Theravadin is where the roots of Buddhism are.
Yeah, I had a similar experience going backwards. I think I practiced Zen meditation and Buddhism for years, and then 3 or 4 years ago during the crisis period, I kind of got stuck, and I was talking to Tim, and he said, well, you should practice metta. So I went to a Theravadin center and started practicing metta, and found it extremely helpful because mm-hmm. he provided me with a outlet that Zen didn't naturally provide.
Yeah. Good. Thank you.
I find there's a very narrow window for me of people I can consider in a neutral way. It doesn't last very long.
You want to say more about that?
They did it, one came for the other.
Pretty quickly. So you got a strong hate lust kind of thing going on there.
What a freedom neutrality.
Yeah. And just before you, one wonders when you talk about equanimity and you talk about non-attachment. Is kind of like neutrality is where that is, or it's an interesting question to think about. And you want you certainly want loving kindness and goodwill, that's kind of fascinating. Yeah, all right.
Maybe the non-attachment that I need is how I feel about them. I need to be unattached to how I feel about people.
Yeah.
I felt somewhat of an in-between kind of a feeling about what I was eating. What was the hardest with myself?
Mm.
I don't think it's a sign of the time, you know, it could be blank, you know, words a couple times. I thought of a bunch of the whole cluster of people that are.
Yeah. Similar to what you were saying. Yes.
I went to a seminar a while back on nonviolent communication, and couldn't help but think of that. Because what he says over and over again is that in a situation where you feel ready to get into a conflict, that the first thing you do is give yourself compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have also noticed that when I think people that I have difficult time with, that there's always an element of what I'm uncomfortable with about them that is an intolerance to who I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just a couple of things. I think this is very strong in Tibetan Buddhism as well. Mm-hmm. And also John Kabat-Zinn and his stress reduction clinic and wellness, etc.
loving kindness meditation is an integral part of that. And of course, it's divorced from Buddhism, just becoming part of a Western mindfulness practice, you know, without Buddhism. But a comment about that, but a lot of places don't start with a person, you know, the individual. You know, they start with somebody just because of all the reasons that were mentioned. And also some traditions like the Tibetan don't start with loving kindness. They start with equanimity because they figure you can't be balanced with loving kindness and compassion unless you start with equanimity. So, you know,
yeah.
All kinds of different practices.
Yeah.
Lee? I found the metaphor in that Pali thing you read of the conch shell to be interesting. And I was wondering if you could, because the sound of the conch shell seems quite limited, and yet previously he seems to be talking about all pervading, you know, we can pervade everything for all time and in all directions with this. So, Lee, what's up with that?
Well, Ben, as you well know, it's part of my response to that is that part of Buddhist thinking, and one would hope Buddhist experience, is that right now, you, Ben, and me, there is no way we are not pervading the universe. I mean, we have our mind that tells us we aren't, but in fact, from a Buddhist perspective, right now we are pervading the universe because in many ways, or we are the universe, and we are totally connected and I will go so far as to say now and throughout time with the universe. So all you have to do is blow your nose and it permeates the universe. So whether it's a conch shell, which is, or a trumpet, it really doesn't matter. Whether it's a gastrointestinal bug, or, you know, a bomb, it doesn't matter. I mean, they really are all intimately interconnected.
I don't know what conch shells you guys have heard blown, but I've blown I've had my own conch shell that I've blown it. It makes a hell of a lot
of
noise.
All right, well, there you go.
And it has a resonance to it that's really pervasive. It's also a really intense thing to blow. It might have something to do with what it takes to blow a conch shell too. The only reason I think I can blow one is because I was a French horn player.
Uh-huh.
You know, and it vibrates your whole body to blow it, because of the vibration you have to generate to get that sound is really intense too. So it might have to do with the person doing the blowing as much as the person hearing it.
Anything else? Any other comments?
I have a question about if this is a basic part of Buddhist speaking.
Well, I think, and it's, you know, it's excluded the way, I mean, we exclude in this tradition, we exclude a lot. We exclude koans, but we don't exclude koans. We exclude things, kind of in a friendly way, and you know, we don't exclude them. You know, we don't say don't read the Buddha. You know, we don't do that. But I think it goes back to the school here, and not just Zen, but let's talk Soto Zen, which is the practice that we do here. really is focused on shikantaza, just sitting. Empty the mind, just be. And there's two reasons for that, Guy. One is, there is an acknowledgement that these tools that we create, whether it's bowing, whether it's chanting, whether it's specific mind games that we do, from a Soto Zen perspective, it's very easy for those to become toys. They can even become competitive toys. So that's one reason Dogen, I think, was so harsh on all this stuff. The second reason is that Dogen, and Dogen is the founder of the Soto Zen school, Dogen determined that the one practice that went all the way from Buddha through all the various practices of Zen Buddhism, the one thing they all had in common was shikantaza. So for that reason, we focus on that. But again, it's not as if we don't bring in other things. We do. I just did. But I think those are the reasons. I mean, if you want reasons that we are so focused and put these other things aside. Yeah.
Seems like the difference is a lot of different forms of Buddhism do this regularly, and this is what they do, and this is how you become enlightened. And you're just mentioning it as, you know, a tool that helps us along the way. But presumably, you know, we probably shouldn't study games all the time, because that's not shikantaza. And you can't do shikantaza if you're playing with mind games. There are paths to shikantaza.
And there are some traditions that practice shikantaza, but they only feel that you can teach shikantaza or just sitting after you've gone through all this stuff, you know. And there's this progression. And again, our tradition, Soto Zen, says there really is no progression. I mean, there's no this, do this first, do this, do that, do that. That kind of gets away from the fact that nirvana is nowhere else. Nirvana cannot exist other than this moment right here, right now. It's not out there somewhere. And so that's a piece that plays into why I think Dogen was so adamant about shikantaza. That just do it. But again, he could be kind of dramatic.
I think they each have their own value, and in Zen, shikantaza brings you directly to kind of the essence. But in Theravada or other traditions, I think they focus more on the mechanics of sitting than in Zen. I guess the one criticism I'd have of Zen is that even though we focus on shikantaza, it tends to become a more, on the higher level, it becomes a bigger philosophical debate, and people tend to grasp onto that rather than maybe the chanting. I mean, in Zen centers, people make Dogen sort of a deity in some ways, and in other traditions, it seems like if you focus on the mechanics of it, that becomes the your deity, or that becomes
your focus. I think if you have, and this is part of the reason I think you want a teacher. If you have a good teacher, a good teacher is going to kind of know, good spiritual teacher is going to kind of know where you're at and what you need. And it's very common in the Zen tradition for a teacher to say, go study with somebody else. That's not my strength, but you really ought to go study with somebody else. Or I think, as in this country, rather than say go to the next mountain, I think we have become much more eclectic in how we teach, and we have more things to offer. And I think it's also important to have a school or have a tradition of just shikantaza. I think that's very important. One more question, and then we're going to call it quits here.
Comment.
Yep.
I was thinking that actually we do kind of glob onto lots of forms.
Yeah, we do.
You know, so that maybe actually Dogen does go into the whole thing about how the spirit can be or the Ryoki or the chant sometimes we feel uncomfortable when we're first starting the form. Like, everybody can think of the first time they've done Orioki. You know, Orioki is like a formal way to be with people, and it's very prescribed and stuff, and people are like, why do I have to do this? But as you get comfortable with it, and get comfortable with the form and kind of digest it, it's almost a way that you can let go of it and not worry about it. But it's almost like investigating the form fully and then being able to let go. And then just do it. That's just like, we don't just do it, you know. It's kind of just, you know, have to experience it. Oh, we also follow our breath, you know, and it's like, that could be another choice.
Yep. So. Yep. Thanks.